Since 9/11, the size and scope of the U.S. intelligence community has grown dramatically. Today, some 1,200 government organizations and 1,900 private companies work on programs related to counterterrorism. The system, a kind of national security industrial complex, employs over 850,000 people at the top secret clearance level alone, and even officials at the highest levels of power in Washington, D.C. have questioned who's really in control of it all. The trend and its potential pitfalls is the focus of a three-part series in the Washington Post called Top Secret America. We are joined now by William Arkin, who co-wrote the series with Dana Priest, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hello.
Thank you for having me on.
What are some of the entities and agencies that constitute Top Secret America?
Well, what we've done is to cut across all of the agencies of the government in order to present as accurate a picture as possible of the totality of the counterterrorism and homeland security effort, which has been created since 9/11. So this includes not just the intelligence community, but also the military and the homeland security apparatus and the law enforcement agencies and the civil agencies who are now themselves recruited into this war on terrorism.
The NSA, the FBI, CIA.
All of the agencies that you've heard of and all of the ones you haven't.
Where in the country are most of these secret intelligence programs located?
Well, it's hard to say where they're located per se, but what we've done is we've tracked where the top secret work is being done. So obviously the epicenter is Washington, D.C. and its surrounding suburbs, where most of the intelligence agencies are headquarters. But really what we found that was also interesting was that there were significant hubs of intelligence activity in other places in the country, in Aurora, Colorado, outside Denver, in San Antonio, in the Tampa area.
Why there?
Well, because either they have become important hubs after 9/11 or because the fundamental structure of the defense industry has changed, and these are the places where, for geographic reasons or even for financial reasons, the national security community generally tended to congregate in, and those then have become the ones that have grown the greatest since 9/11.
It's interesting that New York is the chief target, obviously, Washington the next biggest target, and yet so many of these agencies, these offices are in places that are unlikely ever to be targets.
Well, first of all, you know, I don't look at it as targets, so it's interesting that you already buy into that threat picture.
Mm-hmm.
And one reader wrote to me on Monday and said that our map of the concentrations of Top Secret America looked to him familiar because he used to make these same civil defense maps for where Ground Zeroes would be during a nuclear war 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't help but think that that doesn't also remind me in that way. But I think what's really fundamentally changed since 9/11, what's really fundamentally changed since the 1990s, is that as government has outsourced more and more intelligence work and national security work, and as the nature of information technology has also been transformed, the geography of the United States has also changed. And so not only are we talking about a large edifice called Top Secret America, this sort of underground which exists all over the country in all 50 states, but at the same time, the reality of today's military is that much of the work that we associate with warfare is being done right here in the United States. There's no distinction made any longer between over there and over here in our system. And so when the soldiers and others who are operating in Afghanistan and Iraq are doing what they do, they're completely and utterly dependent upon people who are processing their information, who are translating, who are transcribing, who are moving information, who are analyzing the video from drones, who are commanding their operations even, from people inside the United States. And so we ourselves have sort of inadvertently, or just maybe by virtue of the change in the nature of information technology, extended the battlefield to the United States, and that places the U.S. in a position that most countries are quite familiar with, which is that they are themselves the target of warfare, but it's not something that most Americans think of when they think of the U.S.
As I mentioned, there are 1,200 government organizations, 1,900 private companies doing things related to counterterrorism, and nearly a million people working in or with them. Is there much redundancy in the system, or is each of these entities doing a unique, specific task?
Well, we started this process by thinking, how are we going to characterize what has happened? And we came up with this methodology, which said that everything that happens has to happen somewhere. I'm speaking to you from someplace. You're sitting in a studio someplace. The signal is moving to some tower. It's then going out to other places and then finally to your listeners. So our theory was that everything, even the most secret thing, had to take place somewhere. And we started to collect this entire universe of everythings, determined which ones were doing top secret work, and then determined what contractors they're doing it with them and what the functions of each of them were. This was 2 years of work in order to do this database. And I think in the end, the numbers themselves, the sheer numbers of organizations that were doing the same thing, or seemingly doing the same thing, is what's really surprised us. And it's funny that the government's reaction to this, if we can call it a reaction, has been on the one hand to say it's sensationalized, and on the other hand to say we're taking care of the problem. And the one example that that General Clapper gave in his hearing on the Hill yesterday, where he was being grilled to be the next director of national intelligence, that was something that he felt was valid, was we identified 51 different government organizations who were all doing similar kinds and overlapping kinds of what is called counter-threat finance, trying to stem the flow of money to terrorists. And he acknowledged in this hearing that, yes, that looks like that's an awful lot of places and we're going to take a serious look at it. Well, you know what? That was the only example we gave, because you can only give so many examples. And we have dozens of other examples of this very same kind of redundancies that, in fact, are not to ensure that every angle is covered. They're institutional and bureaucratic redundancies. And I think, to me at least, as somebody who's worked on this for so long, that was just a complete affirmation of our thesis.
Well, with all of these programs and organizations, are there any turf wars for funding and responsibilities, or do they all just get funded?
Well, there's always turf wars, and that's why they all just get funded. I mean, I think that the nature of unregulated bureaucracy is that bureaucracy works on its own behalf. When you add to that the additional factor of secrecy, you really have a powerful combination. So what we've seen since 9/11 is not a growth that then contracted as the situation changed, but a growth that then became permanent, and that permanent growth then had an interest in preserving its own existence. So, you know, if the U.S. government had surged using contractors or creating ad hoc organizations after 9/11 to fight a war in Afghanistan or to mount a war on terrorism until it could mobilize the military, then, you know, we would probably have not written this article, because they would have gone away, and now you would have gotten down to some core of people doing this work. But what happened instead was they surged, they grew, they created new organizations, and all of those things a decade later are still there, superimposed upon the regular military and the regular government.
Well, last year's U.S. intelligence budget was around $75 billion, which is 2.5 times more than the amount of money we spent before 9/11. But you report that that figure doesn't include, as you're suggesting here, many military activities or domestic counterterrorism programs. So is there any way to total up the true cost of all of this?
Well, I'm sure there is a way to do so, but I never feel embarrassed that I can't do it, because they can't do it either. When we spoke to the Secretary of Defense on the record at the end of this series to get him to reflect upon the issues and challenges in front of us, Robert Gates told us on the record that he himself was embarrassed that he couldn't even tell us how many contractors worked for the Office of the Secretary of Defense, that that was data that he had been unable to get. So while it's true that we can put a massive gross figure on defense spending or on national security spending, the reality is that it's so distributed amongst departments and agencies and so hidden in a variety of contracting vehicles, which is what they call them, that it's virtually impossible to give a complete audit of what actually is being done.
The Post estimates that out of 854,000 people with top secret clearances, 265,000 are contractors. Are most of those people who used to work for the government? And how did they get top secret clearances, so many people?
Well, first
and do you
of
think
all,
I can get one?
Well, I doubt it because you're probably not a good enough American. But
thanks a lot.
Nor I. I think that we have to understand the transformation of industry since the 1990s. Because what we discovered in our investigation is that half of the people who are working in this field are working in the IT world, in the information technology world. And that's been the most significant change. The most significant change is that this is not Eisenhower's military-industrial complex anymore. This is now an information-driven, services-driven complex. And there may be good reason why, in terms of IT, that the government needs to reach out to specialists in industry. And given that IT people are very valuable, there may be good reason why they have to pay a premium for them as well in the private sector. And that's why, in fact, much of this contracting has occurred. But the size and scope of the IT business that services this top secret world, almost half of all of the 1,931 companies, really shocked us. And it shows certain redundancies and also certain inefficiencies that you can't really resolve in the presence of secrecy. After all, if I'm Company A and I'm doing business, I don't want Company B to I don't want to cooperate with Company B. I'm trying to smash Company B in terms of profits and in terms of my product or my services. And so the reality is that there's no incentive on the part of the private sector IT world to cooperate and be efficient. What they want to do is preserve their contracting base and preserve their profits. And I'm not saying that that's, you know, anti-American or even that they're not as patriotic and as concerned about our national security as public servants are. But the reality is they are working on their own behalf, and I don't believe that that's what the framers of the Constitution intended when they thought of the structure of American government.
I'm talking with William Arkin, national security reporter for The Washington Post. The Post is running a three-part series called Top Secret America. Well, the NSA intercepts 1.7 billion individual communications a day. It boggles my mind why we need to intercept so many, but it would be impossible to go through them without depending on IT, wouldn't it?
Yes, I think that it's very clear that that we are increasingly becoming information dependent as much in the national security sector as we are in the civilian world. And everything that we feel in our day-to-day lives about information, the internet, our smartphones, the ubiquity of bandwidth, the ability to communicate at all times from all places. I mean, this is something that the government as well has taken advantage of and is operating within. But the problem is that when you superimpose top secret on top of it, then you're talking about inherent stovepipes, inherent clusters, inherent inefficiencies that occur as a result of the compartmentalization that's necessary because of classification. And that's why the cost begins to significantly increase.
You write that contractors kill enemy fighters, they spy on foreign governments and eavesdrop on terrorist networks, they help craft war plans, they gather information on local factions in war zones, They are the historians, the architects, the recruiters, and the nation's most secretive agencies. They staff watch centers across the Washington area. They're among the most trusted advisors to the four-star generals leading the nation's wars. And among them is Blackwater, which has gotten in so much trouble over the years, and even though it's changed its name to Z, they just received $250 million in contracts. Can we trust these companies?
Well, you know, I don't think it's a matter of trust or distrust, but I do think that we have to ask ourselves the question as to whether or not we want to place such an important part of our national security in the hands of the private sector. And the last couple of years, the administration has introduced the notion of insourcing, which means reversing the process of outsourcing that began late in the Clinton administration and accelerated after 9/11. But the irony of that insourcing is that rather than starting by looking at what functions should be performed inside the government, like intelligence analysis or policymaking or things like that, they're insourcing guards, they're insourcing landscapers, they're insourcing people who are merely maintaining the federal government. And to me, that's exactly the wrong approach. I'm sorry. I just think that the most important things should be done by people who are sworn officers of the United States of America. And if we need to outsource the telephone systems and the IT and other things, we should. But right now what we have is everybody doing everything, and that's a system that's just accumulated since 9/11 without any oversight. And that's proven in our series, because there we got CIA Director Leon Panetta, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, the new Director of National Intelligence James Clapper saying it on the record.
Well, who's in charge here? The coverage of James Clapper's nomination, his speech, his testifying before the Senate panel, suggested that whether he makes the he gets the job or not, and he's what, the fourth in 5 years to be appointed to that job, that he really doesn't have much power.
Well, legislatively, this is true, but one has to understand a little bit more subtly how Washington works. You know, this is a team of people and personalities that either do or do not believe in our national security, and either do or do not have the ability to cooperate on an agenda to move forward. The fact that James Clapper is Robert Gates's guy tells me that not only is that a Department of Defense takeover of the Department Directorate of National Intelligence, but that maybe that's not necessarily bad. I have high regard for the Secretary of Defense in many ways, and maybe it's not a bad thing that people who are close and who work together closely are now in the positions of power. I would rather see that than I would see people who are involved in a food fight every day for bureaucratic attention. But I think that what's lacking is a clear statement of strategy from the top, a clear sense of the public's will with regard to what it is that we've done in creating this economy of fear after 9/11. And until that comes, it seems to me that the minions are only going to be able to go so far in reform.
A lot of people in Congress are complaining that we're spending too much money. They didn't want to extend unemployment benefits. This series suggests that money is just flowing out in this area, with really nobody watching or taking care not to overspend. Would it be possible for anybody to try to change that without getting into a lot of trouble?
Well, I think that it will be possible, because I already think we see the percolating uncomfortableness. And one of the things that sort of has surprised me about our long series, that both in the time we've been working on it and the reaction to it Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, has been how it has touched a nerve in American society across the political aisle, Republican and Democrat.
And Mr. Arkin, we have to kind of end it here, but I'd love to come back to you and continue talking about this, because we really haven't gone into the legal aspects of all of this. William Arkin, National Security Reporter for The Washington Post, thank you so much for talking to us about your series with Dana Priest called Top Secret America.
Thank you very much.